Well, we're back again, episode two. We've kicked off the first episode basically introducing ourselves and explaining the two ordinary coppers and the concept behind why we're doing this podcast. And welcome back, Shilty. You excited?
Mate, I'm very excited. We've got a bit to go into in this this episode, and I think it's really good to show people what it's like your first days on the job.
Yeah, the nuts and bolts, if you will.
Yeah.
So, putting it all into context. So, obviously, last episode we spoke about the college. We touched on a few things like the use of alcohol and what can be the good and the bad use of alcohol in the job. And that need to sort of normalise what you're experiencing. And that was what got explained to us early on in training. So, I believe it was late September or mid to late September 2007.
5th of September.
We graduated, yeah, yes. It was graduation day. So yep. Graduation day for any police officer is a big deal. We're sworn in, you're it.
Yeah.
And you're excited, but you're nervous and you're scared. And I want anyone who's a trainee or a probie connie who will relate to that. You really do feel that tension, that pressure, like, wow, what's next? And
definitely. And as I explained in the last one, the first time you go out in public with a firearm on your hip, you know, you're sitting there, you're actually particularly worried. I've got to protect this.
Yeah.
And you're also, we discussed just before we started this recording about going into an incident, and you've got to own it.
Mm.
You're it.
Yep, that's it.
It's a big learning curve.
So, yeah, like we were saying, the 5th of September was graduation day, and then obviously just the practicalities of moving to your first posting, and our first posting was Catherine. So we're in that week or so period after graduation, you're going through the logistics of moving into a new house. Your partner moving down with you. In your case, your wife was already there. We moved down, and you sort of put your gear off at the station, but you've got to realise they're busy. That it's you're the new guy. You don't, you know, who are you, sort of thing. And I think, let me know if I'm wrong, but that first shift, that first time you actually walk in there, I remember asking permission to go and get my belt and my kit on.
Yeah.
And the sergeant sort of looked sideways at me and was going like, why aren't you already in it? You don't need to ask me. So there was that element of, oh, okay, we're grown-ups now.
Like, yeah.
We're just meant to do this. So
I'll just cut in there, Damo. I mean, you know, the thing is also, and what was expected in the police, and especially the good ones, we used to get there half an hour before a shift so you could get up. You were expected to start that shift ready to go. And sometimes you'd be kitted up with 15 minutes to go and some urgent jobs would come in and they'd actually send you out before your shift.
You'd roll out, absolutely. Yep. So I'll go through, and I want you to go through yours. I think we were on the same vehicle we were talking about.
Yeah, we were. So we, at the induction day, was and that's what it was, and we were driving around and they're showing us all different parts of the town, and you know, and like you've explained a number of times, it was all shiny and new, and so you go and have a look, and then they're showing, like, yeah, the I suppose the high crime areas and the problems you might, you know, encounter and all that sort of thing. And it was, I can't remember, it was an 8-hour shift I think the first one, although we did 12-hour shifts back then.
I can't remember. A long time now, but what I do remember is there was a lot of logistics in the morning, so this is where this goes, basically like your first day at school.
Yeah.
This is where your school bag goes, you put your hat there, this is where you put your lunch.
Yep.
So we did all that sort of thing, and that's anyone can relate to that. It's a first day on the job. I think the tension for us was that we're the police.
Yep.
So we're driving around, and then, you know, even in the morning of driving, and you just the recognition that everyone in the street is looking at you.
Yep.
And coming from the civilian world, you're driving around in your car and no one's looking at you.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, you're creating a scene everywhere you go. One thing I noticed was that it didn't matter what you did. When you're in a uniform and a marked police car, everyone looks at you.
Yes.
And that took a bit of getting used to.
It definitely,
and I'll touch on in future how I went from being a plainclothes detective and playing cars back into uniform as a shift sergeant.
Yep.
And I wanted to know what everyone was looking at. So, I was like, what are you looking at?
That's something we need to go on later on, because it is a transition. It's a completely different field.
Absolutely.
When you go from detective to general
Absolutely.
Duties.
Yeah, and we'll touch on that down the
track. We will.
But yeah, that first, we were with the Aboriginal community police officers doing social order duties.
And it was late in the afternoon, if I remember. So it must have been a 12-hour shift, because I think it was about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, which is when, you know, the alcoholism and all that sort of stuff starts.
Yeah. And look, to give some context to people who aren't from the Northern Territory, that particular jurisdiction does have a real issue with alcohol. Amongst other social problems, there's a high domestic violence rate. Unfortunately, it does
massively
affect
high.
The Indigenous communities to a massive extent. So the vast majority of a general duties police officer's job in Catherine, and other towns and centres through the Northern Territory, is proactively removing alcohol from the troubled areas. Now, back then, there weren't as many programs, I suppose, in place or laws in place. So alcohol was relatively freely available.
Yep.
And as a result, you saw that social order issues kicking off at the lowest end, which is your public urination, your public fighting,
yep.
sitting around in the street, drinking in groups, the litter. So that's the social order role that we sort of were immediately involved in. And that in itself was intimidating.
Yep.
To be first on the ground and go, we have to tell these people that we're the police, we are the ones enforcing the law.
Exactly, yeah.
And what you're doing is unacceptable. And it takes a while for that to become normal.
It does, definitely, yeah.
And that's where your senior members and that experience is just so invaluable. That they're the ones who show you how to do this stuff. And you're all scared. The junior guys are scared. And the senior guys are the ones who are calm and in control and going, no, we're doing this.
Yep.
I'll give an example. There's a fellow who's still in the job, a hell of a good guy. I'm pretty sure he's a sergeant or senior sergeant now. I can't remember. I'm not going to name the guy. He's not involved with us here. But he was a senior constable or a first class constable in those early days. Anyway, we knew that we had an alcohol-restricted area. Walpree Camp, just within Katherine. And we knew there was a large amount of alcohol in one of the houses. There was a fairly large group. This is in day two, I think,
yep.
of being a police officer. So everything's new and everything's scary. We go into this group. There's only three of us. Me being the brand new probationary constable, I'm sitting in the back seat and my partner in the front. And we approach this crowd and they're angry. They know why we're there. We're there to remove their alcohol and they want that alcohol and there's tension. He had the strength and the ability to go, no, we are coming in. He did it in such a way that was not a brute force, smash the door and move in there, but it was also not taking a backward step. And it would be very easy to take that backward step, especially being as junior as we were, because of the sheer level of intimidation with the people around. But he showed that you need that strength. You need to be able to do unpopular things.
Yep.
Because it is the right thing. And there was it would have been 10 or 15 people there, becoming quite intimidated, not violent. There was no violence towards us at that stage. And I've certainly been involved in plenty of situations, as you have, where there has been violence towards police. But this is, you've got to remember, very, very early in the role. So the adrenaline is pumping the whole time. There is threat everywhere.
Yep.
And the eyes of fear see danger everywhere.
Yep.
I remember going, my God, he's the bravest person I've ever seen in my life.
Yep.
Well, we achieved it. We removed the alcohol from the place. It was lawful what we did. We carried out our role, that we did our job, and left. And I spoke to him, and he goes, what do you mean? And he goes, oh, that was incredible. And he said, mate, that's your job. You better get used to doing that.
That's right. Hey, well, how many times since that have you actually done that?
Oh, like, and since, thousands. Of course. But can I remember them?
No.
and would this particular person remember that? Probably not. But I certainly remember it. And that was 16 years ago.
I'm just going to cut in there because, I want to actually explain to people that are listening to this is, we also joined the NT Police when the intervention kicked off.
We did.
All right. So we had different legislation depending on whether it fell under the intervention. And in Katherine, we had three main town camps. You would say it was Killarno, Walbury Camp, and...
Just explain the intervention.
Sorry.
Explain what the intervention is.
Yes. So the intervention was brought in by the federal government. It was John Howard at the time. And it was basically to... what would you say? I mean, the main essence was to stop the abuse and sexual abuse in Aboriginal communities.
Yeah, so out of the, I believe it was, and look, the exact details aren't really relevant, but I believe it was the Little Children of Sacred Report.
Yes.
So out of that, it was found at rampant levels of child sexual abuse within Aboriginal communities. So there was key things identified that were causal factors, being alcohol, supply of pornography. And this is all, this is not a political podcast. It was what it was. This is what the government brought forward at the time. The legislation immediately was the Northern Territory Emergency Act.
Yes.
Emergency Response Act. And as a result of that, there were specific powers brought in for the entry into and seizure of alcohol, removal, destruction of alcohol, those sort of powers.
And on Aboriginal land. So, it, yep. and that's the thing. Where, like, there was, so... basically, we had our liquor laws for normal liquor areas and all that sort of thing, and the intervention actually gave us more power when it came to Aboriginal land to actually go in and seize and search and all that sort of
and
stuff.
And I might add, at the time, with quite a level of blessing from from senior Aboriginal elders.
Definitely.
And there was certainly a level of support. There was also quite a deal of Aboriginal police officers who were used with the people enforcing this. So it was what it was. We're not the politicians.
No.
Whether people agree with it or don't agree with it is not relevant to the podcast. It basically outlines the reason for what we were doing and why we were doing what we were. And I don't disagree with what we were doing.
No.
I think we always said it, and you'll agree with me here, that in those early days, I was taught by a number of very good friends of mine who were senior constables and sergeants at the time, some in the job still, some not, that if day shift works hard and removes the alcohol, night shift won't be run off their feet, going to domestics, going to the hospital with not just women, but people who are beaten badly because of alcohol-fueled violence, and mostly, unfortunately, in a family violence setting. So what we were doing was good work. If we remove that factor, that's harm minimization 101.
Yep.
So it was very important that we did that. The other thing that was done, and this gets controversial, where we were taking a lot of, and look, mostly Indigenous people into custody.
Yes.
They were highly intoxicated in public areas.
A high level.
That's very, very intoxicated.
Yep.
So I'm talking blowing in a breathalyzer at 0.4 and higher.
Yes.
So we bring those people into custody, and look, there were programs in place, as you know. We had we call it the Spin Dry. It was basically an alcohol rehabilitation centre where it was run, I don't know the exact organisations, but it was a health-based organisation.
Yep. And they would get a meal in the morning and, know, they get a good bed and...
Clothes washed, sleep in bed.
Clothes washed,
Looked after, monitored through the night. Any health, if they required medication that they hadn't had, they were referred back to the hospital.
And I'm just going to add in there, though, mate, like, what people need to actually understand, people would book in. Like, you've got Aboriginals that are sleeping, like, you know, out on the street and all that sort of thing, and they get to a certain time. They'd actually call us, sometimes on 000, can we get picked up and go to the Spin Dry? Even the cells.
The cells, yeah.
Yep.
So the next place, of course, protective custody was the, that's where the
128 Police Administration Act.
That's where the confusion came in the previous podcast. It was basically a detention power. We called it protective custody. So if a person was intoxicated by alcohol or another substance to the point that they weren't capable of taking care of themselves, the police had the power to remove that person. The first port of call was a sober family member or friend or someone, that responsible person who could look after them. But very quickly after that, it was either the what we called the spin dry.
Yeah.
Which was the alcohol withdrawal centre, basically.
Yeah, like that's
a dry,
right.
A drunk dry out centre.
Yep.
And the last resort was the police cells. Now the trouble is the Spin Dry would fill up pretty quickly.
I can't even remember the amount of spaces they had, but it wasn't a lot. Massive amount.
It wasn't a lot, so that would fill up fairly quickly. And as a result, back in those days, the public drunkenness was quite an issue, and we would have a very large number of people on protective custody within the police cells in Katherine.
Yep.
Now, while they're in custody, it may be argued that there's problems with people being in custody, and we all know the Aboriginal Deaths in Custody Royal Commission from 91, that was a big thing.
Yep.
And that not to be dismissed. However, a lot of these people were a lot safer in the cell sleeping.
Definitely.
Than out on the street being the victim or the offender within of alcohol-fueled violence.
I want to touch on that. I guess exactly what I wanted to get through to the people listening is the fact that we were actually taking these in so crimes didn't get committed, so people weren't getting beaten up. Because it happens. If we didn't, you know, you'd have 50 investigations the next day.
Yep.
And that's why it was safe. And most of the people that came in were more than happy to come in and, you get the odd angry one, but most of them. And there was a large number of people used to, like, especially back in those days.
Absolutely.
On Thursday, Friday, Saturday night, there was a massive amount of people in those cells.
So being a mid-20s, middle-class kid from Toowoomba in Queensland, which is very first world, very lovely place. I quite like the Garden City. I get back up there every now and then. I'd landed in Katherine, having never experienced anything like this, never experiencing this level of disorder. And one of the most foreign things that I remember from my first week in the job was we were offered a domestic violence incident, which was a very common affair and still is to this day. Having spoken to a few of New South Wales police now that I live down there, and it's universal. Australian police, Australia-wide, domestic violence, domestic and family violence is a big deal.
Yep.
The response to it has to be a big deal because it's very important that really dangerous behaviours are identified early and we can put in whatever legislative preventions we can to hopefully save someone from being killed.
Yep.
That's why the law exists. We were offered a domestic violence incident. It wasn't a huge deal. We'd arrested the offender. He was going in for a domestic violence order to be taken out, as it's called in the NT. And as we were walking out, the rear of the cage was open. So yep. The cage door of the police vehicle was wide open. And when we'd pulled up, it certainly hadn't been. So I looked at my partner, who was a more senior member to me, but not by much, by about 3 months.
Yeah.
And he's looked at me going, did you open that? Have we been driving around with that open? I said, no, definitely not. It was shut.
Mm.
And we walked the offender to the rear. He's in handcuffs. He's compliant. We're walking him to the rear of the vehicle. And as we got to the rear, I looked inside, and there are four Indigenous people sitting in the back there, all intoxicated, smiling. And basically they said to us, hello, Constable, can you please take us to the spin drive?
Yep.
They'd opened the cage of the police vehicle.
Yep.
Let themselves in.
Yep.
Sitting in the back waiting for us. So we're like,
yep.
No, because we've got an arrest and we have to go to the cells. That's all right, we'll go to the cells.
Yep.
And I think back in the day, we pulled those people out. We gave them a pat-down search for weapons, and just a standard search that has to happen before you go into police custody.
Yep.
And for those police listening, of course. And then our arrested offender, who was very compliant, knew these people.
Yeah.
So he hopped in the back and they had a good old chat.
Yeah.
And we, all five of us, off to the cells.
Yeah.
Now, I remember the radio call. I remember because we'd made the call, we have one in custody,
yep.
Arrested for this. We've walked out and gone mobile. So we've gone to the VKM, as it's called in the Northern Territory.
Was it 481, 480?
Whatever the vehicle was. And we're mobile. We have one arrest on board for domestic violence offences, and we have four PCs for the watch house. And the response was, okay. We pull up at the watch house with five people in custody, four of which detained themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that to me is a uniquely Northern Territory experience.
Oh, definitely. I remember one day had a guy was actually travelling through the Northern Territory from Europe, and he was outside. It was probably about, I don't know, 6 o'clock at night. We're pulling through the Oasis Shopping Centre, and we all remember Shorty, and we can name him because that's not his name.
Yeah.
Anyway, as we drove past, he waved at us. Anyway, I got out. We pulled the car over and just on the road, got out and I opened the cage. He hopped in and then I closed the cage. Anyway, I'm walking back. No conversation. Nothing said between us. Anyway, I'm walking back to the thing and this guy pulled me up and he goes, what happened there? I said, oh, he's just going for a sleep. He goes, what? What, just going for a sleep? Yeah, yeah. So he locked himself up. Yeah.
Yes.
Yep, he wanted to go for a sleep. And it just, like, the look of astonishment on this guy's face was just incredible.
Yep. And I think that touches on the other thing that I learnt very early on, because we're talking about that very first, these memorable things that stick in my brain because they were so foreign to me at the time. They became absolute norm, but they were so foreign at the beginning of my career. I realised straight away that the police had an outstanding, generally speaking, outstanding relationship with the local Aboriginal people.
Yep.
There were times when they weren't happy about being apprehended, but generally speaking, I think the policing was done very well.
Yep.
It was done with good communication. It was done in a way that was definitely, we were definitely enforcing the law. It wasn't that we were working together. It was that definitely, you know, you need to go for a sleep. You're intoxicated. You either go to your home or you go to the cells or the spin dry.
Yep.
But for the level of dysfunction that we were dealing with, I think we did it well. I'm proud of what we did
definitely.
In those days. I can put my hand on my heart and say that I never did anything to anyone that I wouldn't understand or consider reasonable.
Yep.
If it happened to a member of my family, and
definitely.
I think that's a test. If they were conducting themselves in a similar fashion to the people that we were dealing with,
yep.
I would be understanding of the police dealing with those people that way.
Yep.
I don't think that I would have an issue with that.
Yeah.
And I think you have to relate it back to the people who really matter to yourself. And I liked that test. That was a custodial test.
Definitely, yeah.
Treat these people how you would expect a member of your family to be treated in custody.
Yep.
And I, hand on heart, believe we did that well.
Yep.
Did we do it well every single time? Probably not.
No.
But did we do it for the number of people we were taking into custody? I think we did it really well.
Yep.
And I know that there's a lot of criticism out there about police, but there's also a lot of people who couldn't do it.
No, that's right, exactly. And I'm going to touch on something you said there. 90, 95% of your job is using your mouth. Being able to communicate, talk to people. If you could get someone under arrest without laying a hand on them, that was awesome.
Yep.
Absolutely. Can you remember the use of force philosophy?
Yes, I can. The success or failure of a mission, for want of a better word, will be judged primarily by the
amount of which force is used or minimized.
There we go, Jesus.
Wow. Yeah.
Turns out we haven't completely destroyed our brain.
No.
And you know what? Looking back, it's very, very easy, looking back as a young, gung-ho, want-to-save-the-world copper, and go, let's just get them, let the bad guys lock them up. But I tell you what, they're all humans.
Yep.
They're all people. And if you treat a human being the way you'd want to be treated, you'll always get a good outcome. Does that mean that you don't ever have to use force? Absolutely not.
Mm.
Like I said before, I've pointed my gun directly at a person and had pressure on the trigger.
Yep.
So I'm telling you that my experience was that we got a better outcome where you use good communication skills and acted reasonably. And acting reasonably may mean violent.
Yep.
It may mean that you are using force against that person. But if you can restrain that force to the minimum, and this is not throwaway wank words, and this is not me being one of the bosses of the police executive. This is fact. These people are human beings, and if you treat them like an animal, they will act like one.
Exactly.
If you treat them like a human, if you speak calmly, if you show adult-level expectations of their behavior, generally speaking, those people will conduct themselves in a way.
Yeah.
And of course, not every time. But that's my general philosophy.
Yeah.
And what I love about my first days in the police force, and I'm forever thankful to those old senior diggers who'd been there forever.
Yeah. We were very fortunate.
We were very lucky. There were some very, well, I don't think they want to be called old, but they were. They'd been in the job for a long time. They had a lot more grey hair than I did.
My first senior partner was 10 years in the job.
Yeah,
extremely experienced.
So those old guys, they taught me. They taught me that early on. I remember doing foot patrols through the shopping centre in town, to the Woolworths, and we took a very long time to walk through there. And there were jobs happening, and being young and wanting to rush around town. My old senior partner, I'm not going to name him, he still lives in Catherine as far as I'm aware. He's a great fella, very well-known person.
I think I know exactly who you're talking about.
So he was the one who taught me, just slow down, just drive. This vehicle should go no faster than 40 kilometres an hour.
Yeah.
Leave your windows down.
Yep.
Don't touch your phone.
Yep.
Don't turn the radio on in the car. Listen to the police radio. Don't listen to music. Listen to the street.
Yep.
He taught me very early on that, yes, everyone's looking at you, but you need to be looking at everyone as well.
The windows down is a big one. If you don't know what's going on, you can't prevent it before it happens.
I chipped in later years. They turned out to be very good police officers. One's now an AFP federal agent, I believe, and the other one's an incredibly successful detective sergeant in Darwin. They were driving down the street, they were probationary constables, and I was a budding acting sergeant in Tennant Creek. They were driving down the street, and I was walking for some reason, getting lunch or getting a coffee or something, and I saw them drive past.
As you do as a detective.
I was in uniform at the time, but yes. So they're driving past, both windows
donuts.
Up. That's very much an American thing, right. I believe. So, plus the donut selection in Tennant Creek's pretty limited. So, they were driving past me, and I noticed that the person in the passenger seat was probably on Facebook at the time, and the driver was looking straight ahead. The windows were up, and they were basically doing the speed limit. And they weren't attending a job; they were just patrolling.
Yep.
Had a little chat to them and just pointed it out. But it was what I'd learned earlier in my career.
Yep.
That it was all about. Know your streets.
Exactly.
Know your hotspots. Know your people. Get it. I understand the job has changed. I'm more recently departed from the job. I know that comms hits you with job after job after job. I get it. It's job to job to job. There is no patrolling. But guess what? You can still drive to those jobs. Unless it's a raging emergency, you can still patrol to those jobs and listen to the streets.
Definitely.
Look at the streets. Smell the streets.
Yep.
sense it.
Yep.
Understand what people are saying. Speak to the business owners. Engage the people.
That's right. And that's where you can actually, because you will completely agree with this, if you don't hit something right early on, it can mean a mountain of paperwork later on. And, and people get injured and, you've got victims then, and multiple sometimes. Yeah. You know, if you don't hit it straight away before it happens, that's a consequence. And you create work for yourself if you don't actually be highly vigilant.
Exactly right. Look, I think that's a good wrap-up for number two.
Yeah.
So, obviously, in the first episode, we spoke about our training and we've touched on what we did early in the piece. And it's those, more so for the police, but also I really want to push home to people who aren't necessarily police listening.
Yep.
Those first days, those people wearing those uniforms are humans. And they are inexperienced. They don't know what they're doing. They're doing the best. They have nothing but good intentions. But they're scared.
They are.
It's a scary job. You're the police. The police were the people that you called when you couldn't handle anything.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, that's you.
Yeah.
I'm not saying you don't have support, but it was definitely an intimidating period, and I think it's worth touching on. And I want to let anyone know who's listening that that's normal.
Yes.
We've all been there. You'll deal with that as you get more senior, that other people will deal with that as well.
Definitely.
It's not to be worried about. But look, I think going forward, what do you think we're on about next?
Well, mate, I was actually going to ask you the same question. So you've really put me in the hot seat here. Mate, I actually think we might talk about some of the stations we worked at. So it could be Catherine because, you would have worked at a lot. And a lot of different fields as well. I think what we try and do is just touch on those. And like I said in the previous podcast, go on the internet, send us a message. If you've got any questions, we're more than happy to talk about it. Because we're just trying to get some more education out there about what it's like behind the lines.
Absolutely. All right, well, stay tuned. And look, I hope we're delivering content that people like to hear. And we'll bring out more episodes shortly, and we've got a lot more to discuss.
Well, I reckon for the next one, I'm just going to cut it in there so people can get ready. I reckon we talk about your time as a detective in Catherine.
We can do that. Criminal Investigation 101.
Yep. All right, we'll see you all next time.